This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A very thin layer between the sea surface and the atmosphere may be a major factor in how hot we get and how fast. Since the ocean absorbs at least a quarter of all our greenhouse gas emissions, it's a big deal how the sea surface microlayer operates now and in the future. We have news based on hard measurements from a team of scientists in Great Britain. The lead author joins us to explain. Dr. Ryan Pereira is a research fellow at the Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland. From low river air in the Amazon to the weird spot where the ocean and atmosphere mix, Ryan peers into microbiology and geochemistry of places that are barely visible to the human eye. His latest paper was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on May 28, 2018. From Edinburgh, Ryan Pereira, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks very much.
Well, look, it's good to talk with you. And at first glance, I have to admit, the whole subject of your paper seemed a little fuzzy to me. And then I realized that's because you're exploring places that are really unknown to most of us. For the layperson, what is the sea surface microlayer, or SML?
Sure. So the sea surface microlayer is the skin of any water surface. So in this case, we're talking about the ocean. If you wanted to give an exact depth, it's something around 400 microns in thickness. A way that I often explain it to, as you say, lay people or the neighbor next door, is that it's like the meniscus on your drink or some kind of cocktail. So it's a very, very thin layer.
A meniscus, did you say?
A meniscus, absolutely.
I don't know that word. What's that?
So if you have a glass of water and you hold it up to the light and you look through the glass, you'll see that the water surface itself has got two lines to it, okay, the top and the bottom, and that is the water layer, and that's known as a meniscus.
Great. Okay, now, this surface microlayer must be heaved up and down by waves and tides or drawn around by currents and winds. Does the microlayer maintain itself as constant and everywhere in the ocean?
Okay, so the surface microlayer is physically and chemically distinct from its underlying waters. That's something else that I should have said. And so it does vary in space and time as a function of turbulence. So, for example, wind and waves. So either that's airside turbulence or waterside turbulence. And then as a function of supply of various substances from the underlying water to the surface as they rise up.
According to your studies, key particles within the sea surface microlayer can reduce the amount of carbon the ocean can absorb, and that could increase the amount of carbon dioxide left in the atmosphere and so warm the planet. But to understand, we have to talk about something called surfactants. I thought I knew what they were, but I didn't know what they are in the ocean. What is a surfactant?
Well, a surfactant is a shortened word for surface active substances. What are surface active substances? Well, they are something that is lipophilic and hydrophilic, so water and fat loving, okay? And these molecules, they can stand end on end and form surface slicks in the ocean, but they can also dampen waves on the ocean. And they can be man-made or they can be naturally produced. So naturally produced surfactants could be things such as exudates from phytoplankton within the ocean. You can actually even produce them off the skin of your hands, or they can be produced by man. So soaps, for example, are a natural surfactant, an anthropogenic surfactant that are used obviously in day-to-day, so things like detergents and so on.
Yes, in detergents. I think that's where I first heard about surfactants. They're in advertising or on the packages of detergents. But these ones that we're talking about, though, come from phytoplankton, but they're not phytoplankton. They come from it. What's that about?
Okay, so a lot of that work still needs to be determined. I mean, there's a lot of literature about biologically produced surfactants and where they can come from. I think ultimately we are attributing the surfactants that we have observed to biological surfactants because of the where we have found them in the ocean themselves. So the influence of man-made surfactants is highly unlikely. And we would, we talk about primary producers here in phytoplankton. So really we talk about algal substances or algal communities, shall we say.
And why do surfactants matter when it comes to the ocean as a carbon sink?
So with respect to the gas exchanges that we've been discussing here, when surfactants go to the surface ocean, they can either act as a physical barrier, thereby reducing the rate of exchange or the speed at which gases can travel across that surface microlayer or the ocean film that we discussed earlier, or they can actually dampen capillary waves. So these are waves that are on the ocean surface, and they actually reduce the surface area that allows for gas exchanges. So therefore, you reduce the amount of gas that can travel over one particular area.
And before your new study, Ryan, what did climate scientists assume about the ocean's capacity to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere?
What do you mean by that question?
Well, your study has changed something about the way climate scientists make assumptions about the ocean's ability to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, true?
Sure. So you can't measure gas transfer easily in the fields, because obviously we talked about turbulence, waves, it varies in space and time. And so we typically have to parameterize or the rate of exchange for a given location. And we do that using wind speed typically, okay? And wind speed is something that is fairly well modeled or measured across the globe for various locations. However, there is an uncertainty in the gas transfer velocities, or the speed at which gas can transfer from the atmosphere to the ocean or vice versa, and wind speed, okay? And this scatter creates an uncertainty, okay? And so what we have tried to ascertain is, what is this uncertainty and why does this uncertainty exist? And to do that, we've looked at other secondary factors. This could include bubble formation, but we have specifically looked at surfactants and the surface microlayer.
Right, and you did some earlier work on the wind effect in 2017. You co-authored a paper there. And what did you find that was a contribution to science in that paper?
Okay, so that was actually a prelude to this work here in the Atlantic Ocean, in that we were assessing the role of surfactants in the microlayer in coastal systems. And so we did a fairly similar approach, where we were taking surfactant measurements from the surface water and the underlying water, and also gas exchange measurements. But we were doing them in space and time. So we had a transect that went out from the northeast of the UK, 20 kilometers out into the North Sea, so that we had a salinity gradient. And we then repeated that transect through time to look at seasonal effects, so winter and summer. Okay, and what we found was that there was a summer-winter difference, where we were seeing greater suppressions in the summer, potentially associated with autochthonous or surfactants that are produced within the ocean itself. And then in the winter, we found that the greatest suppressions were near the coast, and that was related to supply of surfactants potentially coming from rivers.
Well, let's get to how you know what you know. You took an important ocean cruise in 2014. Tell us about the ship and the mission.
Okay, so the ship was the James Clark Ross, the research vessel James Clark Ross, which is part of the British Antarctic Survey's fleet that they use to support the British Antarctic Survey effort down in Antarctica. And I was fortunate enough to join the Atlantic Meridional Transect, which is a program that runs every year and has run for about 27 years, I think, now, where the ship during the transport or the voyage down to Antarctica is made available for science, where you can stop twice a day, throw a cast or what we call a CTD, a conductivity, temperature, and depth probe that allows us to collect samples. And we did that twice a day, so during midday and in midnight, and we would collect samples, so that we would then establish a transect of various geochemical or biological parameters going from the UK down to the Falkland Islands.
And climate scientists have used formulas, from what I understand, largely dependent on measurements of chlorophyll taken by satellites in space, but your team on this trip used some sort of tank to take direct measurements from the Atlantic, from the UK all the way to the Falkland Islands. What is that gas exchange tank?
Well, there are a couple of elements to this. So first of all, you mentioned about remote measurements and then point measurements. And I think it's very important to remember that remotely sensed technology such as chlorophyll A, which is done via satellites, is a great way of spatially upscaling and giving a broad scale picture, but that needs to be calibrated to point scale measurements. And the first point is that the surfactant measurements that we were making as a direct measurement on the voyage as well didn't correlate to any of those remotely sensed measurements that we expected would happen. And so this is why we talked about this invisible layer that's infecting the gas exchanges. With regard to your second point, which was about the gas exchange tank itself, what is it? Well, I affectionately call it my fish tank. It's about that sort of size. It's 180 liters, and we would fill it half full, so about 90 liters of water, and then we would add a tracer gas that we would use for measuring the gas transfer velocities, or estimating the gas transfer velocities by measuring the concentration of gas in the water and in the atmosphere over a period of time within this tank. So essentially what we are looking or doing is measuring gas in the water and in the atmosphere over a period of about 3 hours to see how they exchange. And because it's supercharged, the gas concentration is supercharged in the water, what we should see is gas concentrations going down in the water over time, but increasing in the atmosphere or the headspace over time. And we're then able to estimate a flux estimate for that.
Did this new paper come from measurements taken on that 2014 voyage? And if so, why did it take 4 more years to publish it?
Do you know, you're not the first person to ask me that question. The data did indeed come from the 2014 mission. I think, first of all, it's important to note that cruise scheduling and cruise effort takes an awful long time. So, of course, we didn't actually get our equipment back until 2015. So although the voyage happened in September and October 2014, we didn't get all of the equipment, the data back till 2015. Now, of course, we made the tank measurements and looked at the data very, very quickly within 2015 itself. But it's not just about making measurements. It's about establishing a framework to actually understand and contextualize your data. So an awful lot of the work that we did was actually to be able to upscale and really interpret our data for the entire Atlantic Ocean, not just for September and October when we went out on the cruise, but actually to think about the entirety of 2014. So is there a way that we can upscale our point scale measurements for space and time? And that's really what took the extra amount of time, so from 2015 to 18.
Radio EcoShock. If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Ryan Pereira, a researcher from Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh. We're talking in a general way about whether the ocean can continue to absorb our carbon dioxide pollution or the rate that it does. And we talked earlier, Ryan, about the relationship of wind and carbon uptake. Do we have a universal formula that works in every ocean?
Okay, so there are parameterizations that exist for a given wind speed. And you remember earlier that I mentioned that for various wind speeds, we can estimate the gas transfer velocity. And those parameterizations are applied. But the biological aspect that we have brought in hasn't yet been considered. And so further work really needs to go to address how surfactants vary in spaces and time so that we can then start to apply that in different ocean basins, for example, or coastal systems.
Your study looks at the main driver of global warming, carbon dioxide, but does this new look at carbon uptake by the ocean tell us more about methane as well?
It could do. So the reason that we focused on CO2 is that basically we are restricted by the global database. So when we actually measure gas transfer velocities in our gas exchange tank, we actually use methane as our tracer gas. And then we convert using various scaling factors known as a Schmidt number, the scale for various gases based on solubility and diffusivity. And so that's how we were able to determine a gas exchange coefficient for the CO2. Now, the reason that our paper focused on CO2 is literally the database of PCO2 measurements in the ocean and then, of course, the atmosphere, and we're able to scale for that again over the period of 2014, which was when our study was done, and for the different zones within the Atlantic Ocean that we're focusing on. It would entirely be possible to look at methane for exactly the, in exactly the same way, but we don't have the scale of measurements for methane across the Atlantic Ocean to do that.
Why is the surfactant suppression effect greater in the northern hemisphere than in the southern Atlantic? And does it matter that most of the carbon dioxide that could be transferred to the ocean is mainly coming from the northern hemisphere as well?
That's a really good question. Why is that the case? Well, okay, we already know that it's due to the amount of surfactants that are present, and that's most likely as a function of primary productivity. I think we can also say that there may be some forcing there as a result of sea surface temperatures as well, and that's where these warmer waters are. I think with respect to moving forward, I think it is difficult to assess because we just don't really have a wide understanding of the variability of surfactants in the ocean and all of their sources.
Right. And you also talk about hotspots of CO2 exchange in the Atlantic Ocean. Do these matter sort of on a global scale?
Yes. I mean, hotspots of gas exchange, of course, are important because it's not uniform across the Atlantic Ocean. I think these hotspots really are just the first eye-opener as where we perhaps need to focus some of our effort on where we should go back to take further gas exchange measurements and also surfactant measurements to further constrain our work. You know, these hotspots that we've identified are estimates, and I think it would be a first look, and I think we really now need to go to where these hotspots are and do, you know, a primary calibration to make sure that what our estimates are saying are actually true.
We've had experts on phytoplankton on Radio EcoShock, including Sergei Petrovsky, but no one seems sure whether plankton will increase or decrease as the globe warms. What does your study assume, and could that be a further factor in how surfactants in the sea affect the future climate?
So our work showed that with increasing sea surface temperatures, we saw increased surfactants. And so there is a natural feedback loop in the cycle and the carbon cycle here. I think, you know, as you've already indicated, there are experts in phytoplankton and phytoplankton production, and I am certainly not one of those experts, but I think I would predict, or we would hypothesize, that with the increasing temperatures that we would observe, we would expect to see more surfactants as a result of increasing phytoplankton presence or productivity. But of course, I would also expect that there would be some kind of threshold or tipping point where that relationship would no longer hold true as a function of temperature. But when, what threshold value that actually is, that's unknown at present.
So your study, Ryan Pereira, was based on hard data from the Atlantic Ocean. Does it apply equally well to the larger Pacific, or do we have to ship you off to some Pacific islands?
I think you need to ship me off to some Pacific islands, particularly on a good weather day, if that's all right. One with nice beaches are also fully appreciated. No, I mean, in all seriousness, we focused on the Atlantic Ocean because that's where we have primary data from. And, you know, holding my hands up here as a scientist, we had 13 data points that we upscaled from. Of course, we need, and I hate to use the traditional scientific analogy or scientist analogy, but we do really need more data to, you know, look at the seasonal cycle, you know, capturing primary data from, say, the months of January, February, and October, November, where we've seen peak hotspots of activity. And then really we also need to think about how different oceans also behave differently and the circulation patterns associated with that. So, you know, measurements do need to be made in the Pacific Ocean or the Indian Ocean, which really do function completely differently to the Atlantic.
And the abstract for your new paper begins, quote, ocean CO2 uptake accounts for 20% to 40% of the post-industrial sink for anthropogenic CO2. 20 to 40% is a really big range. It makes a very big difference whether 40% of industrial emissions are being absorbed by the ocean or just 20%. Why hasn't this been nailed down much closer than that so far?
Very good question. So that particular statement comes from a reference, and I'm trying to think which reference that comes from at the moment, and I can't answer your question there.
Cunliffe?
Yes, it may well be. Why is the range so high? Very good question. I think, first of all, it's because there's such a variability in the various sinks, and that it also changes in, I keep on saying it, but in space and time. So we already know that the ocean absorbs CO2 at different periods of time because of turbulent settings or turbulence variance, shall we say.
And in part, your paper is kind of a warning to other climate modelers about a weakness of big picture data versus what you actually found taking samples from a ship. What do modelers need to know and to change?
Oh, gosh, what do modelers need to know and change? That's a difficult question. I mean, I am not a modeler. I try to further understand key processes, or at least what I consider to be key processes, with empirical data. I think what the general message of this paper is that we need to make sure that we fully understand not just primary variables, but where we see uncertainty, that we can really look at this, you know, key secondary or tertiary variables that are causing, you know, factors of uncertainty that are likely to propagate out in models when we start to consider upscaling or modeling future scenarios.
And although this is a study of the Atlantic Ocean, Ryan, your paper in Nature Geoscience does consider, quote, global implications of surfactant suppression effect. So do you have any suggestions on what this new study may add to our predictions about the future climate?
Well, gosh, that's, again, a big question. I think what we've demonstrated is that we know that there are hotspots of CO2 exchange, and we need to better constrain where those hotspots are and also when do they exist, because we know that they can move over time, is particularly seasonally. And also what we don't know is how that changes interannually. You know, are different years going to operate differently? So this data is only from 2014, and we really don't know what it was like in 2015, 16, 17, or even this year. Sorry, repeat your question.
Well, I'm just asking about what this means for the future climate, because we found here something that can suppress the ocean's ability to absorb carbon dioxide, and we need that function very badly. And your paper seems to narrow down how that all operates.
See, this is a really difficult question. I mean, yes, we know that the surfactant suppression effect could reduce or does reduce the Atlantic Ocean store by 9%. I think the challenge is that this process has already been happening, but if we're trying to model in the future, then we need, this is actually a really tricky question, like, you know, what is the global implication of our work, right? I mean, that's
exactly
where you're heading with this. How do we want to take this forward? I think what we're suggesting here is that we know that because of this relationship between sea surface temperatures and the presence of surfactants, that a warmer climate, which would be part of this positive feedback, would lead to further suppression. But of course, that will also have a threshold in itself, because increasing CO2 in the atmosphere would create an increased concentrational gradient between the atmosphere and the ocean. But we really haven't been able to constrain those rates, and we really aren't able to predict that in an accurate way, or at least not to my knowledge.
So, Ryan, you've studied optically invisible dissolved organic matter in the Amazon, and now bits that we think come from plankton and a hair-thin layer of the ocean. It must be hard to discuss your work at Social Functions. How and why did you get involved in this line of research?
We observed a relationship that didn't make any sense. I think that's how we got into this idea of invisible organic matter. Tea parties, and I'll come back to that in a second, how I explain my research is that if we take a cup of tea, and let's imagine it's in a glass so that we can see it, and you take your hot water and you add your tea bag, you have got colored dissolved organic matter in there, okay? And you can see it because it's brown in color. If I then add sugar to that tea, it dissolves, okay, but you can't see it because it's invisible, right? But if you started to taste your tea, you would know that it's been sweetened, okay? And that's what we call invisible dissolved organic matter in this case, or invisible carbon. And that's how I explain it to say, my parents or to those that aren't scientists. And the reason that we became interested in this invisible organic carbon was that when we were in the Amazon looking at these organics, we found that techniques that we were looking to quantify carbon during rain events weren't working. They weren't correlating to the total organic carbon that we were measuring via a more robust laboratory method. And so we started to ask the question, well, why is that relationship falling apart? And essentially we found that some types of organic carbon were actually UV optically invisible to various techniques that we use to measure total organic carbon. So this was in the Amazon using various probes, and it's been also upscaled in satellites. So in this particular context, when we come back to the story in the Atlantic, what we found was that the colored dissolved organic matter measurements made from satellites at the same time were not, or the abundance of this measurement wasn't relating to the abundance of surfactants that we were measuring, which is giving us some kind of indication that these surfactants are actually optically invisible to the satellite measurements.
Fair enough. And as we wrap up here, Ryan, what are you working on now, and what are the tasks ahead as you see them?
What are we working on now? I think there's a couple of parts. One is that we really want to try and understand, building on the theme earlier, is, you know, how do surfactants relate to the overall carbon pool? So how are they being sourced? When are they being sourced? And when are they being cycled up to the surface microlayer? And how does that vary in space and time? We talked about other ocean settings, but also coastal settings. And what is the varying effect on gas suppression? We already have done some preliminary work that demonstrates that different types of organic substances or surfactants will actually vary the gas exchange. So the composition type seems to be important for the amount of gas exchange. And so this is the next step for us, looking at the composition of organics, how they change, and the variable rate of gas exchange.
The new paper we've been talking about is titled Reduced Air-Sea CO2 Exchange in the Atlantic Ocean Due to Biological Surfactants. It was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on May 28th. We've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Ryan Pereira, from Harriet Watt University in Scotland. I'll put notes and links to all this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Ryan, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I've learned quite a bit from you today.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.